Welcome to EIR Talks. This week we present The LaRouche Connection, an audio-video news magazine produced by Executive Intelligence Review, which was founded in 1974 by Lyndon H. LaRouche.
My name is Jeff Steinberg, and I'm happy to welcome you to a very special edition of The LaRouche Connection. During the closing weeks of 2001, Lyndon LaRouche, the only present declared candidate for the 2004 Democratic Party presidential nomination, engaged in a rather extraordinary amount of international diplomatic activity. He traveled to Rome, Italy, then to New Delhi, India, and finally to Moscow, Russia, for a series of high-level policy discussions with leading intellectuals and political figures from those three countries to discuss the tremendous economic breakdown crisis of the world financial situation and the solutions that he has been advocating for many, many years to that crisis. Today we bring you the first hour of a seminar that Mr. LaRouche keynoted in New Delhi, India, in December of last year, where he had the opportunity to elaborate the nature of the crisis and his proposals for how to deal with it and avert what others are advocating as a worldwide clash of civilizations, new dark age solution to this imminent crisis that's already upon us.
I'm glad that I have this opportunity to greet and welcome Mr. LaRouche, because I am associated with an institute which is located in Calcutta, and Calcutta is the first city with which Mr. LaRouche's association with India had begun. If I am right, in 1946 he had come there in the wake of conclusion of the Second World War. He had then served in Southeast Asia in the U.S. Army. And since then, Mr. LaRouche had been committed to India. He is an admirer, great admirer of India, and I'm proud that my association with him has enriched my understanding of the ongoing processes in the world. He is a wise man of the Renaissance tradition, an economist who enriched further ideas of Leibniz and invented Leibniz LaRouche method of quantifying the relationship between technical advances and growth of physical economy. It's a pity that in India, LaRouche, though India is very centrally situated in his scheme of things, is not so much known as we would have liked him to be known, his ideas, I mean. But in many important areas of the world, Ibero-America, Latin America, Africa, Europe, Italy, France, Poland, and in Russia, his ideas are acquiring a great influence. I would not like to anticipate what he is going to say here. Once again, I welcome both of you, sir. Mr. LaRouche and Mrs. Helga in our midst, and request you to enlighten us with your presentation. Mr. LaRouche.
Thank you. First of all, we have to redefine history, modern history, because what is usually accepted as modern history is not modern history, it's fiction, invented to apologize for the policies of one or another group, and make up like family history, take invented ancestors instead of the real ones, and much of history has that character. The beginning of modern history goes back, of course, in Europe to the 15th century, to a Renaissance, The significance of that for today is principally that a new kind of institution, the modern nation state, was conceived in Italy in the 15th century, in the Renaissance. The difference between that and all preceding forms of civilization, even though there were intimations of that in earlier developments, the essence of this revolution was that for the first time, the idea that one group of people could rule over other people as virtual human cattle was denied to be a principle of law. This was the imperial principle of law, on which from ancient Mesopotamia, Sparta, the Roman Empire, the Byzantine Empire, and European feudalism had been based on the idea of a majority of the population being treated like a limited minority, as if they were wild or tamed human cattle, and hunted down, bred, utilized, and culled according to the pleasure of the masters, as the Malthusians today argue, if the population is excessive, unregrettably we'll have to cut the herd. The same kind of idea. So under the modern nation state, it was established that there is no moral authority for government, except as that government is efficiently committed to promote the general welfare, the common good, of all of the people over whom it rules, and their posterity. That's the base, that principle of the general welfare or common good is the foundation. This idea was first brought to successful expression in France under Louis XI of France, who made a revolution in creating the foundations of modern France out of rubbish. This was echoed, this French Revolution was echoed in England by the overthrow of Richard III and the installation of the government of Henry VII, who was sane unlike his son, Henry VIII. So, at that point, the forces of oligarchy, led by Venice, sought to overthrow the nation state. And the nation state, as a result, was thrown into a period of civil war, religious war, from 1511 until 1648, until the Treaty of Westphalia. Under these conditions, the possibility of restoring the kind of nation state which Louis XI of France, or Henry VII of England, or Henry IV of France had attempted to bring into being was in jeopardy. And therefore, Europeans looked to the Americas, where European colonies had been developed, in the hope that republics of the desired form could emerge in this area. This did not succeed in the Spanish area, principally because of the Habsburg influence internationally and British influence. But it did succeed in the United States, in what became the United States. Now, the United States was created with the backing of all the leading intellectual circles of Europe, and the good ones, in France, but throughout Europe as a whole. The major intellectual influence in shaping the United States and its constitution was Gottfried Leibniz, the great scientist of the 17th and early 18th century. The ideas of Leibniz, as opposed to those of Locke, or opposed to those of Hobbes, were the foundation of the American constitutional system. The problem we had in creating our republic is we had a rotten element inside it, but we prized as we had the same problem in India, of course, in the freedom of India. You had to take what you had and make a government of all of the elements, including some which might not have been too agreeable at the time. We had that too. We had a financier interest, closely tied to the British East India Company, principally, in New York and Boston, the Boston area. We had also southern slaveholders, centered in the Carolinas and Georgia. These were elements which were polluted the founding of our nation. In the wake of the Napoleonic Wars, the French Revolution and Napoleonic Wars, the United States, which had just been created, became isolated. And thus the wars on Europe became the determinant of the fate of the United States. which was a small nation floating like a cockboat on the seas of the world as a whole, and always in jeopardy. You became incorruptible. The power of a Enoch-centered financier group, the power of the slaveholders, increased until Lincoln led a revolution which overthrew a British puppet, the Confederacy, and established between 1861 and 1876, established the United States as the most powerful single nation-state economy, the most advanced technologically on this planet. This occurrence is viewed as 1876 by leading Europeans led to a revolution in Europe and Asia. It led to the so-called Meiji reforms of the 1870s in Japan. Modern industrial Japan was actually a personal creation of Henry Carey, the leading economist of the world at that time, employing his student, A. Pesheim Smith, into Japan to guide the Japanese in creating the foundations of a modern economy. At a later point, you had in China the influence of Sun Yat-sen, who was educated and developed in Honolulu, who became the leader of the struggle for the foundation of modern China. In Russia, Mendeleev, the great scientist of Russia, was at 1876 at the Philadelphia Centennial Exposition. He returned to Russia, delivered his report to Alexander II, and with the later support of Graf Witte, established the American model as the direction in which the Russian economy was being developed. It was Mendeleev who developed not only the Trans-Siberian Railroad with the cooperation of Witte in the but also created most of the industries of Russia based on the American model. The letters of Mendeleev to the Tsar on the subject of industrial projects in regions in which the rail system was being constructed are a model for reference still today. Thus, in France, there were positive influences after the ouster of Napoleon III. This went on until about the 1890s. In which the American influence was an increasing influence throughout the world in shaping the direction of reforms in the old world. In none of these cases was a true republic developed in Eurasia. You had Tsarism in Russia. You had the Hirohito or the system, essentially, as we referred to it in the World War II period, in Japan. You had oligarchy ran Europe. You had the Habsburg tyranny, which was still squatting like a succubus in Vienna. You had all kinds of relics of the past. And what Europe did was essentially make certain reforms. The reforms were reforms in feudal institutions. The parliamentary system is a feudal relic. It was created by imposing reforms upon monarchies, which the forms of parliament, which had been created originally to represent the oligarchy and advise the monarch, were compelled to make concessions on lawmaking to various levels of popular opinion. And this gave us the parliamentary forms, which people in Europe prize as being a game. They are vulnerable forms of government, as you know, because a parliamentary government is inherently subject to destabilization. We're going to have a parliamentary crisis. The government's out. So therefore, the problem in parliamentary systems is to maintain a long-term continuity of policy, sufficiently long-term, and I'll come to that, sufficiently long-term in order to make projects successful. So presidents are elected, and governments composed for a certain durability, which have democratic features within them, but are durable, which means that people can make commitments to terms of 5 to 10 years and longer in terms of policy. And virtually no reform could be carried out in almost any country effectively and brought to success in less than a 5 to 10 year period, which I'll get to. So, but despite those shortcomings, we had around the world in the late 19th century what looked like an American century, that is the influence of the success of the American Revolution as attested by the developments of 1861-76 as a model for reform of the world as a whole and of relations among states. This changed during the course of the 1890s. The British monarchy recognized that the development of trans-Eurasian rail systems and economic development meant an end to the ability of a maritime power, imperial maritime power, to dominate the world as a whole. Remember historically, as you know from the history of, or sometimes prehistoric history of India, in which the Dravidian-speaking language group dominated the entire Indian Ocean region and its adjoining littoral as a great maritime power. Sumer was created by Dravidian-speaking peoples. Yemen, Abyssinia was developed by Dravidian-speaking peoples. The culture which radiated from the subcontinent radiated all over the oceans of Indian Ocean and Asia. So, the British had inherited that idea of maritime power. And power, economic power, was largely based on the littoral areas adjoining the oceans or up the riparian rivers and riparian systems of the rivers. The inland areas of the continents were not adequately developed, as in China today. The great problem of China today is the coastal region and the great riparian channels tend to be developed economically. The inland regions, beyond the reach of the coast, beyond the great riparian continents of trade, are not developed. And that's the great problem there. However, if you develop systems of transport and power across the continent, as we did in the United States with the transcontinental railway system, then you can unite a continent and it becomes cheaper to move freight across the land mass and much quicker than by sea. And this results in a great revolution. So therefore, under the conditions typified by the Benveniev work in developing the Trans-Siberian Railroad, the threat was that Eurasia would unite in cooperative ventures of this sort, linking the Atlantic Ocean to the Pacific Ocean across the landmass. And this would make a great revolution in the human condition, under which the interior of Eurasia would become a development area. This London recognized as a grave threat to the power of the British Empire. And therefore, the British developed two plans. One typified by Admiral Fisher, the head of the British Navy, who invented the dreadnought, the so-called dreadnought policy, to dominate the seas absolutely, and also to create Kuwait, which was originally owned entirely, stolen by the British monarchy and owned by it, and created as a source of oil for an oil-fired British Navy, intended for what became known as World War I. So, but the idea was, how do you overthrow and disrupt the tendency for cooperation among France, Germany, Italy, which emerged as a nation during this period, Russia, Japan, China, down to India? How do you do that? And they came up with the idea called geopolitics. Set the nations which you wanted to have cooperative against one another's throats. This was called World War I. World War I began in France in about 1892 with the Dreyfus Affair, which was actually a plan for the overthrow of the existing government of France, making the way for the horror show, which came in later. 1898, the power of France was destroyed by Kitchener above Khartoum and broke the attempt of the French to create a railroad system which would link Dakar to Djibouti across the sub-Saharan region. This led to the formation of the Entente Cordiale between France and Edward VII. This led to the Balkan Wars, to the increasing alliance with Russia against the Ottomans with France. This led to the folly of Germany in allying itself with Austro-Hungary, which lured Germany into the trap of what was called World War I. Now, the crucial feature here, which defines modern history, is 1901 assassination of the President of the United States, McKinley. McKinley was the last president in that period until Roosevelt, who represented the American system tradition, as exemplified by Lincoln. This brought into power a man who was a total British asset, Theodore Roosevelt, who was the nephew of the man who had been the leader of the Confederate Intelligence Service and trained by him. So you had a British agent, Teddy Roosevelt, took over the United States, and with his friends in Wall Street and among the former slave owners of the Confederacy, established their power over Wall Street. This was done directly by Edward VII through Jacob Schiff, who was Edward VII's chief agent in Wall Street, who created the Federal Reserve System, and some other things. Wilson, who's the important successor of Teddy Roosevelt after Taft, and was put into power by Roosevelt's intervention, was a man of the Southern tradition, the Confederacy tradition, not only pro-slavery, but an admirer of the Ku Klux Klan, and the man who, from the White House itself, launched the mass revival of the Ku Klux Klan in the United States, leading to the Ku Klux Klan horrors of middle 1916 period through into the 1930s. So American racism today is essentially a consequence of the revival of pro-Confederacy views by a Democratic president, Grover Cleveland, who introduced Jim Crow, by Teddy Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson, who were advocates of the Southern cause against the Lincoln tradition, and all of whom were allies and essentially governor generals for the British monarchy, of the British monarchy. This began the phenomenon which defines the 20th century, 1910, the Anglo-American imperial century. The interruption and disturbance of this came with one president, especially, Franklin Roosevelt. Franklin Roosevelt was the great-grandson of one of Hamilton's collaborators, Isaac Roosevelt, an ally of Hamilton's. And Franklin Roosevelt represented that family tradition, the patriotic tradition, against what was called the English tradition or the British tradition. So he attempted to use the occasion of a crisis to attempt to reverse the trend back to the Lincoln legacy. This was the cause of the Roosevelt era, his characteristic, and this was the impulse behind Roosevelt's commitment up until the time of his death and just slightly beyond for decolonizing the entire world. As he warned Churchill in the famous meeting of Casablanca, that Roosevelt's intention was that the power of the United States, which was established by the close of the Second World War, would mean that the United States would have the power to bring about the instant freedom from colonial rule of all colonial subjects of Portuguese, British, French, and so forth in Dutch imperials. And Roosevelt's body was not cold before the Truman administration accepted Churchill's proposal, and Indochina, Indonesia, and other parts of the world were colonized, or recolonized again, which led, of course, to the emergence of the non-aligned movement in the immediate post-war period, the reaction to this kind of recolonization process and its implications. So therefore, if we can understand the entire history of this period in those terms, leading up to the present, here's some of the breaking points which have to be kept in mind. Therefore, you have the 1861-1901 period of U.S. history, of world history, which might be called the period of the ascendancy of the American Revolution's influence in changing the world as a whole, and threatening to bring about what John Quincy Adams, who had been the actual mentor of Lincoln, had intended, a community of principle shared among perfectly sovereign nation states. The intent of Roosevelt was exactly that the world should become, in the post-war period, a community of shared principle among sovereign nation states, each perfectly sovereign. This was disrupted, of course, by the 1901 development, the assassination of Kennedy, which was done by a British-linked influence, run by a terrorist mob, steered from London. It was broken in 1945, but there were some features to this, complications. Roosevelt's impact on the world, and the United States' impact on the world under Roosevelt, could not be denied. So although the decolonization policy of Roosevelt was canceled within the week he died, nonetheless, the Bretton Woods system, created in 1945, essentially launched after the war, until 1963-64, functioned very well for the countries which participated in it. You would find in most of the Americas, as in the United States, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and so forth, and in Japan, and in Western Europe, that the Bretton Woods system functioned to the net benefit of the populations in terms of an improvement in the standards of living and similar kinds of benefits. That the world as a whole was better because of that system, despite the injustices and despite the disparities which were included within it. With the assassination of Kennedy, this came to an end. I'll take the characteristics of this. You have the period from 1962 to 1965 was a period of great crisis. The crisis for India, for example. The India crisis, the war with China, the things that broke Nehru's heart were all a reflection of this change. The attempted assassination of President Charles de Gaulle in 1862, the ouster of Macmillan with the Profumo scandal orchestrated in that same period, 1963, the assassination of Kennedy, these and other things were all reflections of a fundamental change in policy from the Bretton Woods system. And with the launching of the Vietnam War and some other things, the policies of the United States and other nations began pushed away from a policy of expanding economic progress, economic development, into a policy of Malthusianism, or so-called neo-Malthusianism.
You're listening to EIR Talks. To replay this program or to read the transcript, visit our website at larouchepub.com. That's www.larouchepub.com. Welcome back to EIR Talks. We'll continue now with the LaRouche Connection, produced by Executive Intelligence Review.
Under this policy, the world economy has decayed as a whole, consistently over the entire period from 1965-66 to the present time. The crucial point was 1971. You had the Wilson government in Great Britain, which first inaugurated the destruction of the economy, the destruction of the British economy, the United Kingdom economy under Wilson, the first Wilson government, was unbelievable. It was terrific. This was imitated in the United States beginning 1966-67. The force initiating this was the Nixon campaign for the presidency in 1966-1968. During this period, 1966, Nixon went down to Mississippi and other places to negotiate with leaders of the Ku Klux Klan and allied races such as the Trent Lott, who is presently the leader of the Republican faction in the U.S. Senate. Therefore, Nixon embraced racism as an evil policy. following Nixon's introduction of the 1971 destruction of the Bretton Woods system, which led to all of the world financial chaos, which is now hitting us, the Democratic Party decided it too had to join the racist cause. And therefore, Zbigniew Brzezinski picked a fool, Jimmy Carter, to become president, and hand-steered him and controlled him with the New York crowd from the beginning to the end. Jimmy Carter did more to destroy the U.S. economy than any president since the death of Roosevelt by himself. Deregulation and radical introduction of free trade, the introduction of the destruction of the world economy, which was done by Paul Volcker, with his Volcker measures introduced in 1879, which is the policy of the Brzezinski crowd, which has now been continued by Greenspan, the successor of Volcker. So that system has been the problem. So this is a crucial part of the whole process. During this entire period, from 1945 to 1989, the world was dominated strategically by a peculiar kind of alliance and a hostility between the Soviet Union and the Anglo-American powers. A hostility which became a kind of partnership based on hate. Nuclear weapons had been introduced from London by the faction of H.G. Wells and Bertrand Russell with the explicit proposal that by introducing nuclear weapons, you would create a situation in which nations would surrender their sovereignty rather than risk war, and therefore would give up sovereignty for world government. So this was the Iranian. The way they started it, they started a conflict between the Soviet Union, the United States, and Britain, which was launched from London, which began the entire period. This evolved from 1961-62 on, evolved into a peculiar kind of partnership between the two opposing powers called Entente. So the world was now managed by whatever the United States and Britain on the one side and the Soviet government on the other side could agree to in terms of world policy. This was an integral part of the process of disintegration and marked the significance of the 1962-1965 period. This was the period in which the post-war developments had been brought to the point through the missile crisis of 1962. It had been brought to the point that the world was now ruled by a peculiar kind of detente arrangement between two central power blocks, and the rest of the world was subject to that. This meant doom for all of the aspirations of the non-aligned movement and similar kinds of things among the developing sector generally. Look at the pattern. Yeah, well, India and China are powerful nations in their own right. They're not world powers, and therefore have been able in various ways to resist this, as was the characteristic of the Indira Gandhi government in particular, her governments in particular, to resist this particular entrapment, this cage, this captivity of the agreement between two superpower blocks, which was the problem of India during the entire period of her prime ministership. How do you negotiate the survival of India and India's interests when the world is dominated by a pair of superpower blocks? So this led to 1989 and the inevitable collapse of the Soviet system. The collapse of the Soviet system was then seen by the Anglo-American powers as the occasion for destroying the institution of the nation-state, which had been first introduced to European civilization in the 15th century with Louis XI and with Henry VII. Malthusianism, globalization, free trade, so forth, These were measures intended to destroy, to eradicate the roots of the nation state and its culture from the world. This was a policy based largely upon destruction. People have been looking for stealing. Well, stealing goes on because that's the instinct of these creatures. But the essential strategic purpose is destruction, not conquest. Because if you can destroy the institutions which defy you, then you have conquered by default. This means Malthusianism, which I'll come to in a minute now. It means Malthusianism because you can, if you, as long as you have to educate a population to master modern technology, the education of that population in science and technology creates a population which is not going to consider itself, will not accept the idea of being human capital. If you can think, if you understand the laws of the universe, at least in some degree, if you understand the principle that man can improve his condition by willfully mastering nature, then you are not going to accept being cattle. Therefore, if you wish to reduce the human race to a mass of human cattle, ruled over by a minority and oligarchy, like an Anglo-American globalized oligarchy, you have to destroy the ability of people to maintain technological progress. You have to eradicate much of the roots of existing technological progress. So now you come along and you say, we have to defend nature against man. When you go to defend nature against man, what does that mean? You're wrong. But what you're doing is you're demanding the greatest collapse in the level of the human population in a rapid period ever imagined. You're demanding global genocide. You're demanding the destruction of those institutions upon which the modern society is based. That is the intent. If you read the literature, you get in the conferences, you get into the fights with these creatures, who are the advisors and think tank associates of these kinds of policies, that's what they say. They say it in one way or another. The best way to smoke it out is to propose the contrary policy. And they'll run screaming around like banshees around the room, around the ceiling. And that is the problem we face. You have a group of people who have been determined to destroy, and they said it, neo-Malthusianism, ecologism, globalism. These are the means, the policies by which the destruction of the human race over several successive generations has been intended. And it's working. Look at Africa. There are virtually no African nations left. Africa has become a no man's land, which Anglo-American and Israeli mercenaries deploy to kill, to organize killing, and to loot raw materials. Look at South Africa. South Africa has virtually no sovereignty over its own raw materials resources. Anglo-American interests control the thing entirely. Look in Central Africa, the Great Lakes region. Look at it today. You have a genocide going on beyond belief. This is the image of the world, the future world, and we let it go that way. Image for India. It's the way you understand what's going on in Southeast Asia. Right, now let's look at economics from that standpoint. The issue then becomes that of economics in that sense. The crucial thing is that mankind is the only species which has the willful capability of increasing its population density. No other species can do that willfully. No other species can change its own apparent nature. Species can adapt to their conditions, but they cannot change their nature. And that's the essence of economics, and that's the essence of the issue in economics today. We have one kind of economics, which is essentially Malthusian by implication. That's called accounting. It's called contemporary accepted science. Because in accounting is essentially linear. It does not allow for any radical change in fundamental principles of science. Does not allow for that kind of society. You teach people how to manage existing technologies, not how to introduce new ones. For example, let's take the case of India, as I saw it when Mrs. Gandhi was still Prime Minister. I looked at the IITs, I looked at the problem in India. India was producing some of the world's leading academically qualified people. Were being exported to the United States and Europe and elsewhere. You took the top 10% of the graduates of IITs, and they were being shipped around the world to find employment outside of India, not in India. Then you look at the other problem, which is imposed by the India's defense of itself against the IMF and similar predatory institutions, which meant that you maintained a tight budget, which is intended to protect this precious independence of India, which depended upon the farmer. Therefore, you could not open up the Indian market for free trade, because once you did so, then the farmer would no longer be free as a farmer, and then India would be torn apart as other countries have been torn apart, which do not have agricultural independence. So Mrs. Gandhi, in a sense, was right in her tight money policies, her tight policies against conceding to free trade demands and her tight administration of policy. But the effect was horrible. The effect was in the universities itself. What we see in the IITs, the ones I visited, you saw a lack of pedagogical experimental apparatus. You saw a lack of access to experimental research, experimental development, which meant that you were doing something terrible to anyone who studied physical sciences in particular. You're denying the ability to understand physical science, which means you're producing a nation of great mathematicians in one sense, but who are not necessarily good physical scientists, who do not have the impulse to go out and do what India needs, which is develop science and apply it to the Indian production, Indian population itself, to raise the level of productivity of the land and people of India. So there was a trap where, in order to defend India as it was, India was being denied the ability to develop India as it must become. The same problem is the problem you see in China. You have an agricultural population which is precious. The independence of the country depends upon that food supply by that population to be the independence of the country. It's also a source of export income. You see in China a similar characteristic, a different kind of situation, but a similar problem. Here are two countries, the largest countries, the largest population of any planet on this nation, on this planet, neither of which has had the freedom to fully develop scientifically the productive forces of its own nation. And this has resulted in a kind of stagnation in certain respects within the national economy. We see the same thing in other parts of the world, but this is the Indian situation, and I refer to it particularly within this concrete. Now the problem is this: when you teach science at the level, you are creating a problem. Because the flaw that is created is that the teacher attempts to make the scientific discovery plausible without giving the student the experience of the paradox which promotes the discovery of the principle. The attempt is made to make the scientific principle plausible by a mathematical exposition at the blackboard. But in point of fact, let's take two great discoveries as points of fact. Modern comprehensive mathematical physics was begun essentially by followers of Nicolas of Cusa, who was the founder of modern mathematical science, physical science. And followers of Cusa, Luca Pacioli and his promising student Leonardo da Vinci. The great follower of the explicit follower of Cusa, Pacioli, and Da Vinci was Johannes Kepler. Johannes Kepler was the founder of modern comprehensive mathematical physics. He was the discoverer of universal gravitation, and no one else. This discovery is recorded in his, the originality of his discovery is recorded in his famous book, 1609 publication, New Astronomy. The completion of this discovery by him was essentially summed up in his world timing. We went to the planetary system as a whole. Now, these discovery in this case was based on what? All previous European systems, that of the Hoekster Claudius Ptolemy, that of Copernicus, and that of Tycho Brahe, were all intrinsically based, because they assumed that you could, that the universe functioned in terms of perfectly circular motion as defined by the blackboard, by drawing circles on a blackboard or on paper or similar kinds of things. And it doesn't. Kepler pointed out that is in the orbit of Mars that you had an apparent eccentricity, that the orbit was elliptical rather than circular. And through his experimental work on this question showed that there was a principle operating which could not be explained at the blackboard, but that there was a principle existing outside the blackboard and similar minds, an intention which was governing the regularity of these astronomical cycles. This became the base, this was the principle of gravitation. You had a similar discovery by Pierre Fermat, the French scientist, who showed that in reflection, as opposed to refraction, might appear, as the fellow at the blackboard would argue, that the light is propagated in terms of shortest distance. But he also discovered that in terms of refraction, light is refracted in terms of quickest time. Therefore, geometry as taught at the blackboard does not correspond, and mathematics as taught on the blackboard does not correspond to reality. What is at stake here? It's a very elementary principle, which Vernadsky struck upon from a different sense, which is the difference between economics as taught today and economics as a physical science. Economics as taught today is linear mathematics, which has no correspondence to reality. The physical reality. It is at the blackboard, it is on the computer, it is linear, it's wrong. The collapse of the so-called new economy, the great bubble, the so-called information theory bubble, which has just collapsed catastrophically around the planet, is a demonstration that von Neumann was a hoaxer and an idiot and not leaner too. But people believed in it because they wished to believe that you could explain science and economics at the blackboard, not by work, not by actual production. It also denies the nature of man, which is the crucial issue. Man is the only creature who can make discoveries in the way in which Kepler and Fermat did. The human mind is capable of a capacity which sees the world outside the limits of so-called sense certainty. Sense certainty is what? Sense certainty, or the senses, do not show us the real world. The senses report to us the experience of a part of our biological apparatus and try to interpret the experience on the periphery of our system and try to find out what is going on outside our skins to cause the things that we feel inside our skins. This process of discovery is what is properly called science. Is it, how do we discover? We discover a paradox. We discover that experience shows us that some things don't work the way our senses tend to suggest they do. Microphysics, for example, is a perfect expression of this. All of microphysics is based on things which are very efficient, which determine our power to exist, especially today, but which exist beyond the power of our senses to detect. How do we know these things? We know these things because we solve paradoxes with a power of the mind of insight into the significance of certain paradoxes in our experience, like physical paradoxes, like the paradox that Kepler used to discover gravitation, the paradox which Fermat introduced, which caused modern European science to develop the so-called relativity of physical space-time conception. The same thing is true in economics. The basis of man's increased power over the universe, the power to exist, the power to increase the lifespan of populations, which is the power, by increasing the lifespan of populations, to increase the possibility of the development of populations. Because if you have a lifespan of expectancy of 30 to 40 years, how can you have a developed population? Who is going to support the children for 20 to 25 years in development if the parents are dying between the ages of 30 and 40? You can't do it. It's impossible. Therefore, the important thing is, how can we increase man's power to act in and over the universe to improve the lifespan of our people, to increase the amount of development we allow for our children, who are really children from the ages of, essentially, from 0 to 25 today in terms of professional development. How can we provide 25 years of life of a child to the full development of that child's cognitive capabilities as a future adult? How can we do that? We must improve the productive powers of labor to the included effect of increasing lifespan, increasing the possibility of health care to which threatens lifespan, and by these means we make it possible to improve the quality of man. We educate people how properly, not how to learn to repeat what someone said before us, but how to re-experience the great discoveries from the past. That's, for example, why is Vedic in Sanskrit so important in India? Because we know that that aspect of the language, as Panini reflected, came from a long time before. I saw in one of these science magazines a recent discovery of argument about three different views on the significance of river systems, which already existed in part to the west of here some ancient times ago. This is important. Also, as Tilak emphasized, we know that these things today, we know scientifically that Tilak was right, that some of the ancient calendars which are transmitted to India come from ocean cultures which are Arctic ocean cultures. We also know from the work of Barry Bell and others who trace some of these linguistic patterns throughout the waters of the Pacific and Southeast Asia, that there were great maritime cultures which existed, which have had impact upon people. And if we're going to understand the roots of language, if we're going to understand where our people came from, we're going to understand the various influences which shaped the culture which a cultivated person can have today in any of these countries, they must, in a sense, be allowed to experience what their remote ancestors experienced in the way of important discoveries. Ancient poetry, for example, is extremely important for this, especially the classical forms of ancient poetry, which reveal to us certain characteristics of language and enable us to criticize the language we're using today by insight into how language is developed. So the key thing is to develop a person who is what? Who is an effective reflection of the great contributions of past mankind to the present, especially of the immediate population of which he's a part, the immediate culture of which the person is a part. And to be qualified to address not only the current problems, but to foresee the requirements which the future must have from the present. And this is economics. That the idea of accounting for things, of course, is obviously necessary. But we should never try to develop an economy based on accounting. We should rather look at the past, the present, and the future, and say, how can we foster the development and utilization of those discoveries of principle which represent man's discovery of increased power over nature, and how we organize those discoveries and those create the conditions of work under which we can bring forth the future. Therefore, man is, in a sense, mortal or immortal. Man is mortal in the sense that our lives have a beginning and an end. We are immortal as no animal is immortal, because we are capable of re-experiencing cognitive discoveries of principle which no animal could make. We benefit from these discoveries from our predecessors, from whom those discoveries are transmitted to us. Our children should know those discoveries. We should not die without transmitting those discoveries to our children. Our children should learn from that process of re-experiencing discoveries how to make their own discoveries, how to judge the present and the future. We must have a sense of mission of what mankind must accomplish 40, 50, 100 years from now, a vision of what that must be. We must make our policies today on that basis. For example, just in conclusion on this point, infrastructure, basic economic infrastructure, transportation, power, water management, education, healthcare is about the same thing. These are the essence of economy.
You've been listening to EIR Talks. To replay this program or to read the transcript, visit our website at larouchepub.com. That's www.larouchepub.com. EIR Talks will return in a moment with closing announcements.